It's my pleasure. I'm Jim Malcolmson, by the way. I'm a professor of economics. If any of you don't know me, I'm a fellow of the college here. And it's a real pleasure for me to introduce John. In case, just, for those of you who don't know, John started out life as what I think would be reasonable to call a straight economist. He always had a reputation for deep thinking about serious issues, and I think it says a lot about John that, unlike most economists, philosophers accepted him as one of their own and appointed him to a prestigious chair of moral philosophy here in Oxford. And I don't know whether you're the first economist who's managed to make that transition, John, but it's certainly a big transition to have made. Anyway, I'd be really looking forward to what you have to say on these issues.
Thank you very much. We agreed that we would play this by economics rules, so don't expect me just to talk for 35 minutes and then shut up. I will expect you to interrupt me whenever you feel like it. And I don't have one coherent message that I'm trying to put across, so I don't mind if I get to the end or I don't get to the end. It doesn't matter. Morality isn't just one thing. Some moral philosophers think it is, but I don't. I think that moral requirements or moral duties can come from different sources, not all from the same place. And I'm going to describe two different sources. I don't necessarily think these are the only ones there are, but I do think there are these two. And they lead to different ways of thinking about intergenerational ethics. There's first of all moral duties of goodness. Philosophers more technically talk about beneficence. So these are duties of beneficence, and those are duties to make things better, to improve the world. And I'm pretty sure we do have these duties. I certainly think that governments have these duties, at least to their own citizens. I think that ordinary people do, but that doesn't actually make any difference to the argument I'm going to make. But governments, I think, certainly do, and that does make a difference. But that's not all there is to morality, making the world a better place, because sometimes it isn't your duty to make the world a better place, and in fact, sometimes you're not even permitted to make the world a better place in particular ways. So to take a trivial example, suppose that you and your friends, if you were to have a noisy party lasting far into the night, you would enjoy it tremendously. You'd get lots and lots of fun. It would cause misery to your neighbor, who would be, you know, really upset, but actually the fun that you'll get is quite enough to outweigh the misery your neighbour. It doesn't mean that you're morally permitted to go ahead and have the party. You might well be morally prohibited from having the party because it causes this pain to your neighbour. Another example, one that's very well known in philosophical circles, is the transplant surgeon who has 5 patients in her hospital. One of them needs a kidney, one of them needs a heart, one of them needs a liver, and so on. And they'll die if they don't get these things. So what she does is take an innocent visitor to the hospital, kill her, take out the organs, distribute them to the 5, thereby saving 5 lives at the expense of 1, which makes the world a better place. 5 lives are better than 1. But it's obvious that she's not morally permitted to do that. There has to be something or other that says you can't do, morally, you can't do that sort of thing. So those examples show that there's got to be some other source of moral principles that can stand against beneficence. We have a duty to make the world better, but sometimes that duty can be opposed by something else. And the particular duty that those examples brought up is a duty not to cause harm to people. And we do have a duty not to cause harm, even for the sake of the greater good, sometimes. So this is not just a duty not to harm in a way that can be weighed against greater good. It's not just a duty to take account of the harm you do into account when you are making a decision what to do, weigh the benefit against the harm. It's not just that, a duty not to take to take harm into account. It's a duty actually not to harm that sometimes goes further than that. So we have one, yeah.
So in the first case of the party and the person being harmed by the party, is there not sort of moral duty on the person being harmed to in some way accept the temporary suffering because in a sense, it's duty to allow others to enjoy themselves in that case?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Okay, so I think it does seem to me that if you are the person who's going to suffer, you have it within your rights to waive your right not to be harmed. That's true. That's a common feature of rights. I'll come to rights in a moment. So it's certainly permissible for you to waive it. Is it your moral duty? No, I don't think. In some circumstances, no doubt it would be. You know, there are some cases where you should accept a small harm for the sake of greater good for people. There's got to be some way of distinguishing ones where it is and ones where it isn't. And I don't know. And so I don't even know in that particular case. And I'm just about to say there's something else I don't know about this principle. But I certainly wouldn't take it for granted that that's what you ought to do, that you ought to waive your right in this case.
Can I ask you a related question? Since is that you began with the word duty, and I wonder, in a way, you're leading us in one particular direction. Duty has a very strong force behind it.
Yeah.
And I can be thinking of things I ought to do without thinking it's a duty to do.
There are certainly things you ought to do without its being a duty. For example, you ought to look both ways when you cross the road, and that's no duty. But that's because it doesn't come from morality. I didn't mean anything heavy by using duty. And if you don't like it, then can you translate it to yourself into something else? I could have said moral requirement. Would you have been happy with that? So it's not that simply a moral reason, okay? It's not that there is a moral reason to do this. It's more than that. If it's a requirement and there are no opposing requirements, then it follows that you ought to do it.
Right. It's the contending considerations which always bother me, and I suspect the economists are constantly thinking about seven different forces pulling us in eight different directions.
Yeah. And it's true that these two moral sources of moral duty that I've been describing can conflict with each other, and we'll have to say something about conflicts. If I was presuming too much in calling it a duty, would you be happy with requirement?
No,
okay, think of it that way.
I mean, doesn't the way in which these sort of conflicts are resolved depend on some kind of underlying sort of moral sense of entitlement? Or is the neighbor entitled to his sort of noise-free environment? Is the visitor to the hospital entitled in a way to her life? And just to put it in very sort of easy terms of the sort of global commons problem, all these things, to an extent, you take the Coase theorem and how to solve all these issues. The issue about entitlement, who has the right to the gains to any form of cooperation or not, are you going to propose a particular framework, I guess?
Well, I am going to say something about rights in a moment, but I think the issue was, so I was just assuming that the neighbour had a right, and I'll say more about that in a second. The issue was, is it a moral requirement on the neighbour to waive her right? And I don't have a view about that. I mean, I could see that there are cases in which you would have a moral requirement to waive a right. But I don't know what to say about this particular case. But shall we get to rights, and then maybe we can stop again. So all I've said so far is that there is some principle, and I haven't specified it at all in detail, which can stand against a moral requirement to. I'm going to get fed up with saying requirement all the while. So a moral duty to promote good, The examples point to a moral duty not to cause harm, even sometimes for the sake of the greater good. Now, there isn't a universal moral duty of that sort. There are plenty of occasions when it's actually permissible to cause harm to somebody else. So you can do it in self-defense, for example. You can do it if you're inflicting a deserved punishment on the person for having done something wrong. Sometimes you can do it with her permission, and that might be permissible. So it's not a universal principle. And that means there must be some boundary between cases where it's not permissible and cases where it is permissible. And I'm sorry to say I don't know the boundary. Yeah.
Corporations, you often hear, are obliged to do things that are socially wrong because they have a duty to their shareholders.
Very good. Don't
you? And that made me think about you started off with governments having a duty to do good, but you might argue that governments have a duty to their shareholders, as it were, who might be very selfish altogether, the people who vote them in.
Can I stick with corporations for the moment? The idea is that corporations have various different moral demands on them. There's the moral demands of them as actors in society, and there's the moral demands that come from the people who own them and are entitled to some sort of profit or other. And those two things may easily conflict. I agree. Now, what I mean by moral duty is something that arises at the resolution of those things. So it may be that the corporations have a moral duty to do nasty things, or it may be that they have a moral duty not to do nasty things, and whichever of those is the truth emerges from these conflicting responsibilities that they're under. I'm not going to try and resolve them. With governments, things are different because they have special democratic responsibilities. They need to give legitimacy to the decisions they make by basing them on democratic procedures. And that's a much more complicated business, which is part of political theory, which I really don't want to get involved in. So I said that it's difficult to know the boundaries of this principle not to harm. I'm going to take it to be a principle of justice. Now, I think some people might object to that, and I don't mind terribly if the term doesn't appeal to you very well, but it does have a characteristic which is typical of duties of justice, and that is there's always somebody to whom it's owed. So if you're under a duty of justice to do something or other and you don't do it, which is to say you commit an injustice, there's always somebody to whom you've committed the injustice. And we say that that person has a right to its performance. So duties of justice go along with rights. When I talk about a duty of justice, I take it for granted that it's a right, and the moral duty of justice that applies to somebody is owed to the person whose right it is. And that's the case for the transplant surgeon, obviously. The surgeon owes it as a right to the person who innocently comes to her hospital not to kill her. And the your unfortunate neighbor has a right not to be hurt by you in this way. So that's a characteristic of duties of justice, and that's actually really the only thing that I'm going on in calling this duty not to harm a duty of justice. Contrast it with duties of goodness, which are not, most of us think, duties that are owed to people. And to make that clear, I think it's worth thinking about a philosopher who thought that it was. William Godwin, an anarchist philosopher from the late 18th century, was a utilitarian, so he thought that what we all ought to do is promote good. But the thing that sets him apart from most utilitarians is that he thought that the duty to promote good was actually a duty owed to the people whose good it is. So if you could do good to somebody by giving her something, not only ought you to do it, because that promotes good, but actually you owed it to that person to give it to her, and he even went so far as to say she owns it. So he claimed that the person that ownership resides with the person who can make can get the most good from some particular object. And he claimed that the duty to promote goodness was a duty of justice. He was explicit about that. And it would count as a duty of justice on my definition if he was right. If it is indeed owed to the people whose good it is that you promote their good, then that would make it a duty of justice, and he called it a duty of justice. Now, I mention him, I think his view is perfectly coherent, but to contrast it with what most of us think. I don't think most of us think that if we fail to benefit somebody who we could benefit, we are necessarily doing an injustice to that person. We don't think we owe it to that person to do a benefit to it, and we don't think that that person necessarily has a right to it just because she would benefit from our action. So I think on the way that most of us see the duty of beneficence, it's a different one. It's not a duty of justice. There is a real difference between duties of goodness and duties of justice. Let me say, so I'm making a distinction. This is going to run through what I'm saying at the moment. This is not meant to be a distinction on grounds of high theory. And I'm not saying that at the highest level, moral theory is going to contain this as a fundamental distinction between different sorts of morality. It may well be that at the level of high theory, these things merge. What I'm saying is that at the level of practice, we should certainly recognize the difference. They may merge, and you can see why. Can I just finish the sentence? You can see why. I mean, an injustice is a bad thing. If you do someone an injustice, that's a bad thing, and it's a bad thing that she suffers. So you're doing bad at the same time as you're doing an injustice, and it might well be that this bad could be incorporated in some way or other in a general theory that what you should do is good. Sorry.
Just reflecting on whether there's a practical component of this. In South Africa, quite a bit of our constitution actually reflects rights of beneficence. Thus, for instance, it is a right of citizens to housing, to water, to electricity, things which they didn't have under apartheid. And that's pretty much shared by 50 million people. So the legal framework, the philosophical framework, and the everyday framework is something to stark contrast to.
Yeah. I'm talking about moral rights rather than legal rights, and the two things don't always go in step. But it may well be that a political system is actually able to create legal rights. It's just possible that in South Africa, the political system is able to make it the case that people have a moral right to housing. And in that case, an injustice is committed to them if they don't get housing. Somebody or other will be committing an injustice. But just because it's a legal right, it doesn't follow that it's a moral right.
Well, I agree, but you're appealing to commonsensical conceptions of what justice is and what a moral right is. And the point is that commonsensically in the country, not just in the legal realm, but in the moral realm, people think about these rights of beneficence as justice, as,
Well, not all of them. I mean, you've mentioned some rights which are created out of doing a good for somebody. That doesn't mean that all sorts of doing good are going to be considered as a right. And so there is still the distinction that I'm making, even if the place has moved owing to the way that people are thinking in this particular country. There is still a boundary there, and I told you I didn't know exactly where the boundary is.
Yeah, but I mean, the boundary here has shifted from, you drew a distinction between beneficence and harm, right? And you were saying that it was duties of harm that are very clearly rights, whereas duties of beneficence are not. And I'm saying that's not really.
Oh, I see. No, I didn't want to say that this is the only duty of justice. The only duty of justice is not to harm. There are lots of other duties of justice. Not to imprison somebody for a crime they didn't commit, and so on. So I don't think that they are all duty. Oh, and there are duties of justice involved in property. So most of us think that if you own something, you have certain rights towards that thing. And people have a duty of justice to respect those rights. So the duty not to harm is one, but not one among many. That's what I meant.
Maybe I'm phrasing it wrongly, but remember you brought up the crazy attitude to the tyrant from the 18th century, and you said his view of beneficence was that they attached to particular individuals, that the individuals themselves were owed these rights of beneficence. And he said, look, this is clearly crazy. Most of us feel in a different way.
I didn't think he would say it was crazy. I just said most of us don't think that way.
Okay. But I'm giving you a kind of a practical counter example. So that's all.
How much of this rests on a distinction between procedural and absolute notions of justice, in the sense that, you know, the imperative not to do harm privileges the status quo in a way that the South African Constitution does not. And I mean, and it's sharper than that because, you know, creating a right that everybody should have housing is not going to make everybody in South Africa better off. It'll make most people better off, but it will harm other people. Is that an important distinction?
Sorry, what was the distinction that you're asking?
Between absolute or end state ideas of justice and procedural ideas. Procedural ideas take the form, here's the status quo, I could do something that would harm you relative to the current status quo, and it's wrong for me to do that. And on the other hand, there's the example that I extracted from the young lady's example is, you know, we don't have a status quo, or we don't privilege a status quo. Rather, we construct property rights that mimic what the status quo should be, and take that as the basis of our notion of justice.
There's a question of what counts as a harm, and the sort of issues that you're talking about are concerned with that, I think. I'm not sure I would describe this as a difference between a process justice and end state justice. But let me recognize that harm is generally meant to be relative to something or other. And that's something which is going to have to be defined in order to make sure that we've got a proper a complete theory. And I'm skipping over that. As I say, I'm not doing high theory. I'm just trying to do common sense at the moment. So what I've tried to do is point out that we mostly recognize on common sense levels, there are two sorts of morality, two sorts of moral duties, and I'm now going to start applying them to intergenerational ethics.
So just a quick question. On the distinction between you and William Godwin on beneficence, would you also distinguish yourself from Tim Scanlon as well?
I'm not sure. I mean, he thinks that by far the majority of moral duties are owed to people. But he doesn't think that promoting well-being is a moral duty. So I think promoting well-being is a prime example of doing good. And I do think that's a moral duty. So it may well be that we both have the same idea of the distinction between duties of things that are owed and duties that are not owed. It's just that he thinks the one that I think is really rather important isn't one at all, or not an important one. I think that's probably it. Against my better judgment, I've found myself doing climate change quite a lot lately, which takes me into the intergenerational justice, which is how I come to be here, I guess. And it also involved me in having dealings with two different sorts of people that I wasn't having dealings with until this happened. On the one hand, I have found myself having dealings with political philosophers now. And on the other hand, with economists. And the two have very different views about morality. The political philosophers, I've noticed, see everything in terms of justice. They speak of intergenerational justice, climate justice, and so on. In fact, political philosophers really speak of very little else. It's as though they think the only thing there is in the world of any value is justice. So that's one point of view. Everything is justice. Then on the other hand, there are economists who deal only in goodness, in effect. They don't use the term very much, but they see that their typical approach to deciding what governments ought to do or what the international community ought to do is to think of something which needs to be maximized or promoted and find ways of doing that subject to whatever constraints they're facing. That something is called sometimes social welfare, intergenerational well-being was the term that Partha was using, something like that. But whatever it's called, it's what they're treating as good because it's the thing that they're aiming to promote, and I take it that's the criterion for the thing being good. If this is what they aim to promote, then that's the thing that they're treating as good. And this is a slightly overbroad statement, but I don't think economists really deal in justice at all. It's true that they sometimes talk about distributional justice, but I think mostly what that means is that they value equality. They think that equality is among the good things that they're aiming to promote. I think, in any case, that this term distributional justice is a bit of a misnomer. I don't think it's really, in most cases, anything much to do with justice. I think it's just a name for the view that equality between people is a good thing. It's one of the things on the side of good, what we might want to promote, rather than anything much to do with justice. But that I don't want to pursue that subject because it might take us far from the thing that we're really talking about. So anyhow, the result of this is that the two disciplines, political philosophy and economics, so they do both talk about intergenerational ethics, just talk past each other. And so the question is, which is right? Is it all about justice or is it all about promoting goodness? And the answer is, I'm pleased to be able to say this, since I think there are a lot more economists here than there are political philosophers, that at least when we're dealing with the duties of governments in the international community, the economists are right. The intergenerational ethics, public ethics, the duties of governments and international communities, those are derived from goodness or from beneficence mainly. Something from justice, but not very much. And I'm going to explain why. Now, this will be an interesting experiment. I'm going to talk about something called the non-identity effect. My experience is that although the non-identity effect seems to convinces me, and it convinces quite a number of the philosophers I know, people other than philosophers are entirely impervious to the arguments that come from the non-identity effect. So you may find yourself not convinced at all, but let me tell it to you. And this is a point that was made prominent largely by the All Souls philosopher, Derek Parfit. He actually hates my mentioning it because he thinks that all sorts of bad moral conclusions have been drawn from the non-identity effect, and so he wished he'd never promulgated it. And it is true that all sorts of bad moral conclusions have been drawn from it, but I think they're drawn incorrectly. That's to say, they don't actually follow from the non-identity effect, and I do think, since it is a truth, this effect is a truth, we really have to take it into account. So let me describe it. So suppose the government does something serious about climate change, our government, say, a big government I'm talking about, does something serious about climate change, well, that's going to make quite a difference to people's lives. You know, we're going to have to stop traveling about so much, we're going to have to be more careful with energy and so on. We're going to have to live in different ways. And as people start living differently, then they will meet different people from the ones they would have met had they not done it. So if the government does something serious, then people will, communities will be different, social life will be different, people will meet different people, they'll have babies with different people, choose different partners, and even if they have the same partner, the partner they would have done, they're likely to have babies at rather different times, the timing of birth is likely to vary, and all of those things mean that different people will be created by the process of procreation that takes place in the social circumstances. So the effect of serious action on climate change will be that the next generation will actually consist of different people from the present generation. Meanwhile, if we do something about climate change, the climate won't be warming so much, so life will be different all over the world as a result of it, and similar things will be happening all over the world. And within a couple of generations, we can expect the whole population of the world to be different from what it would have been had we not done anything about climate change. That's a non-identity effect. Major action on the part of governments changes the identity of future people. The world in 150 years will consist of different people from the ones it would have done. Now, that's got two consequences. Suppose we don't actually do anything much about climate change, carry on with business as usual, so that the people living 150 years from now are not living very good lives because the climate is so badly damaged. Well, those people have not been harmed by our action, because if we had been less negligent and done something about climate change, those people would not even have existed. So our action of not doing something about it hasn't harmed those future people. And furthermore, we're not failing in our duty, a duty we could owe to anybody in this negligence of ours. We couldn't owe it to those future people who will be living 150 years now. It couldn't be that we owe it to those people to have prevented their existence and have created a different lot of people instead. So it's very difficult. This is a conclusion I draw. Not impossible, but very difficult to see our failure as a failure of a duty of justice.
Yeah. Have you never read some dystopian novel where you get the sense that people think, well, would it be better we'd never been born or never been born into this world? I mean, isn't that something that you sometimes get characters saying in literature and so on?
Would be better. I think they're making a mistake if they say it would have been better for me. But that's a serious question, is would the world be better without anybody in it? Or would it be better if... would it have been a good thing if I hadn't been born? That seems to me also a serious question. I don't think it's a serious question to say, would it have been better for me if I hadn't been born? Though some people disagree. I mean, let me say that philosophy is the least unified discipline that you could imagine. And some people do think that it... well, they think it might have been... I mean, supposing that I'm leading quite a decent life, they think it might have been worse for me if I had never been born. I don't think that, but there is a view that way. And what I just said is highly controversial. It's not, you know, I said that our negligence in not doing anything about climate change doesn't harm any of the people alive in 150 years, and we could owe it to them not to do it. Both of those views are challenged. There are people who find ways of saying, yes, we do harm them by our negligence, and people who find ways of saying, yes, and we owe it to them. We owe it to them not to have done what we did, which is the thing that caused their creation. It seems to me that's you can make claims like that. It's going to be an uphill struggle to convince people. You know, it does seem to me that if we do something, and had we not done it, that person would not even come into existence. It's very hard to say that what we did was harming that person.
I quite agree with you. I was just wondering whether one way of phrasing it would be to suggest that non-existence is not a state for the person.
Well, so there's another way of putting it, which is the one that I was relying on, which is that there are no non-existent people.
Exactly. So that's it's a rhetorical device saying, I wish, you know, I would have been better off not being born. It's a meaningless sentence to me.
I think, look, can I just get through to the end of the non-identity argument and then pause? So I do think that people disagree with that, but I myself don't see why they bother, really. Why are they so anxious to say these things about harm, which on the face of it look as if they're pretty implausible? I think it's because they really want to see our responsibilities to the future in terms of justice. They're probably political philosophers, or they're influenced by political philosophers. They think everything is justice. And if we don't have a duty of justice, then we don't have any duty at all. But I think that's an error. We have a very serious duty to promote good. And if we don't do anything about climate change, then the world in 150 years is going to be a lot worse than it would have been had we done something about it, even if there are different people living there. So this non-identity effect, I think, does actually show that we shouldn't see it in terms of justice, but it does not show that we don't have important, serious moral duties to do something about climate change. And the people who get anxious about the non-identity effect are the ones who haven't understood that we have a separate duty of beneficence. And that's why I think that economists who on the whole think in those terms are doing the right thing. That is what we should be doing when we're thinking about climate change. We should be trying to pick the way of making the world the best possible place and not worrying about justice. Right. Why not you first?
So can't we slightly square the circle by thinking about it in terms of the dynasties? So we have a duty of justice to the people who are alive today and who are still people either way, and they care about their future generations, so it's justice to them in the form of their caring about their descendants to take this action.
Well, why is that something to do with justice? I mean, I'm not sure that there's a duty of justice to do to somebody what she happens to care about. And, they have views about the goodness of the future. They care about the future. Well, I care directly about the future. You know, it's not just that I care about the next generation and care about the future because they care about it. I care about it anyway. Yeah.
There seems to rely a lot on individualism. So if you think of a person not as an individual but as a member of a community, so people living in Oxford in 200 years' time, then that is...
Yeah. So you're right. So the argument depended on my assumption that duties of justice are owed to individuals. If you can make out that duties of justice are owed to collectives, like the generation alive in 150 years' time, or to some nation or something like that, then you will be able to overcome this complaint. And that is one of the routes that people take. So they try and make out that duties of justice are not owed particularly to people. They could be owed, say, to people occupying roles, to roles rather than people, you know, the role of being somebody alive in 150 years. So they're not, I don't find that very plausible myself, but it's a way of running the argument, I guess.
So if you accept the identity argument and that policy influences who's going to be alive in the future, what does it mean to make the world a better place?
Lives in 150 years are better than lives in 150 years would have been had you hadn't done it.
So, but whose lives?
Well, it would be different people's lives.
So basically, all individuals should be treated equal in...
Well, I mean, that's rather leaping beyond what I said, but all individuals count, yes. So, I mean, it's not as though I'm suggesting there is some other sort of goodness other than the good of individuals. All these people are living living lives, and we care about how good those lives are. It's just it doesn't matter whether the people who live... given what we do, are the same as the ones that would have lived if we'd done something differently. We still care about goodness in the world, even if it's not always goodness of the same people, the good of the same people, yeah.
That'd be a minor point. I'm not trying to cue to fully myself, but isn't also part of its sort of view of individual person across time that essentially it's, in a way, the same person is someone, something else, at a later point in time. So at which point the policy to kill the visitor to the hospital changes that person. This whole idea that the duty is owed to an individual, and the fact that any policy is going to change which individuals are there, when policy is going to change what person your neighbor is going to be on the night. So in a way, I'm not 100% sure that the non-identity effect stands water, holds water against.
Okay, I should have seen this coming, actually, now I think about it, yeah.
Yeah. All over, right?
So, that's very, very interesting. Because I realized during our discussion earlier that economists seem not to see people as people. I mean, what they think, I mean, Parther actually said that he's not the same person as he was 3 days ago. Now, sort of figuratively, that's correct. He doesn't have the same properties, all the same properties he had 3 days ago, but he is the same person. And there is a tendency, so I'm not accusing of this, but there is a tendency for economists to think that a person is constituted by her preferences, so if her preferences change, then you've got a different person. That's not true. There is a difference between somebody changing her properties and somebody ceasing to exist and a new person coming into existence. I'm talking about people. And people do persist through time. Now, there is a, you know, there is in Derrick's work something that you could turn into an argument that says rights are not owed to people, but they're owed to shorter periods of a life or something along those lines. We could make that. I really don't want to do that, not this afternoon. And
when I thought that this comment over here made sense to me, that I care about my great great grandchildren, and my great great grandchildren are my great great grandchildren. Of course, I don't know who they're going to be. You know, so that they marry, that they're the other, this set of genes are mixed in with mine, or some other set of genes. What do I care?
I think that's right. Yes. So what you're interested in is the good of your great great grandchildren, not considered as individuals, but as roles. Yeah, and that's what I'm saying we should do. We should be interested in the good of the people who will be existing at some time in the future. We shouldn't try and think that this is a matter of justice. Because if we thought it was a matter of justice, then we would have to be the individuals.
I guess the thing is, if you go back to common sense, the ordinary person will think of my great-great-grandchildren as being individuals. I don't know who they're going to be, but yeah. I think of them as individuals, and I think of them as being capable of being harmed by my actions.
I could give you an example, you know, of how you could harm one of them by your actions. You could, you know, in your will, you could determine that something is done to one of your grandchildren great-great-grandchildren in 150 years that's harmful, but you could make sure that that will does not in any way affect the way that life goes, so it doesn't affect the identity of that person. So it is possible to do harm to people in the future. Individuals in the future, but it's a difficult thing to do. Toby. Okay, you're right. Look, I've got 15 minutes. There is one more thing I want to say. I never really wanted to say everything here, but let me just say this one thing. So I do think that the non-identity effect shows that the duties that matter for intergenerational ethics are duties of goodness, so long as what we're thinking about is the actions of governments and big organizations. For individuals, that's much less clear. Because although my actions as an individual will have non-identity implications, that's to say they will affect the existence, some of the people who exist in the next few generations, I rather doubt that they will affect most of the population of the world within a few centuries. So I have a much less powerful non-identity effect than governments do. And that means, in principle, it is possible for me to own duties of justice to people who will be living in 150 or a couple of hundred years. The non-identity effect does not make that not possible. And actually, I think I do. Emissions of climate change do harm. They do harm to some currently living people, and they do harm also to people who will be living in 150 years. So my emissions of greenhouse gas are in fact doing harm to a lot of people, and that means a lot of individuals. And although, as I said earlier, some harming is morally permissible, it's not a universal rule that says you may not harm other people, there is a rule that's against harming. There is a moral rule against harming, a rule of justice that I said. Justice requires you not to harm other people, even sometimes for the sake of the greater good. And I think that in the case of our emissions of greenhouse gas, they fall on the wrong side of the boundary. I don't know where the boundary is exactly, but our emissions of greenhouse gas, I think, fall on the wrong side. We are, in fact, doing an injustice to people by our emissions of greenhouse gas. Now, since I don't know exactly where the boundary is, I can't explain this, why this is conclusively, but I can mention some characteristics of our emissions, which I hope will be enough to convince you that this really is so. So now I'm talking about individuals' emissions of greenhouse gas, and I'm going to say that the harm that they cause is an injustice. So I'll mention characteristics. I'll leave out some obvious ones, like they're not being done as rightful punishment to the future generations. They're not being done in self-defense and so on. So here are more less obvious ones. First thing is that what we're doing to the harm we're doing is a result of something we do rather than something we omit to do. So In living our lives, we cause greenhouse gas to spew out of the exhaust pipes of our cars and out of our chimneys, and these are the results of things that we do. Some people think that there is a difference in moral status between doing something and refraining from doing something. So suppose that you could send some money to improve the lot of impoverished people in India, but you don't, so you're refraining from doing some good. Some people think, well, that's not an injustice. I think a lot of us think that's not an injustice, refraining from doing good, but this emission of greenhouse gas is not like that. It's not that we refrain from doing good to future people. We actually, by our actions, cause them harm. It's an action rather than an emission. One characteristic. Secondly, it's not accidental, of course. We do it knowingly. Few of us do not know the harm that we're doing by emissions. This is not a reciprocated harm. A lot of environmental harms are reciprocated, like congestion, for example. If you drive about in a congested city, you're doing harm to the people around you by getting in their way, but they're similarly getting in your way, so they're doing harm to you, so this is a reciprocated harm. And we might well not think on those grounds that it's an injustice. But emissions are not like that. They're generally in one direction. The rich are causing emissions that harm the poor. It's at any rate the emissions of, it's those emissions that I'm talking about, the ones that are not reciprocated. We don't compensate the people. You can sometimes annul an injustice by paying compensation. We don't do that. Most of us do it for our own benefit. Now, there are some altruists among us who might continue to emit greenhouse gas, use the money that they save by doing that, because it costs money to reduce your emissions, use the money that you save by doing that for the benefit of other people rather than for yourself. Altruistic people. I'm not addressing altruistic people. I'm addressing the rest of us, the majority who are not altruistic, and when we emit greenhouse gas, we're mostly doing that for our own benefit. And I said it's not permissible sometimes to harm even for the sake of the greater general good, but it's particularly not permissible to harm people for the sake of your own good. So that's another characteristic. And the last thing is that we can actually easily avoid it. And we can do that by offsetting. Now that's a rather controversial remark. I'll come to offsetting in a moment. It's actually quite cheap to eliminate your emissions of greenhouse gas. So the conclusion I come to is that our emissions are an injustice, so there is, we, as individuals, this is not to do with governments, as individuals, it's our duty of justice not to emit greenhouse gas. I'm only a moral philosopher, I'm meant to deal in generalities and stuff, but here am I, I'm preaching a particular moral principle, don't emit greenhouse gas. And I think that's the reason for that is that you are doing an injustice to people when you do. You're harming them in a way that's not morally permitted. So there is a difference between our duties, the duties created by climate change on individuals, their duties of justice, duties created by climate change for governments, I've just been saying, are principally duties of goodness rather than duties of justice. As it happens, I don't think there are any duties of goodness on individuals to reduce our emissions. I simply think we ought to reduce our emissions in order to avoid that injustice. Can I just see what I want to say essentially before I... go on.
So you were asserting that governments primarily have the duty of goodness and individuals the duty of justice. Is that because most of the harm of climate change falls on future generations relative to present generations?
Yes. But there is more to it. So I do think the governments also have duties of justice, which I've not emphasized, because I think governments are doing an injustice to people who are presently being harmed by climate change, and there are presently living people. I think that, from the point of view of governments, that's a relatively small part of the harm that they're doing. Most of it is to future generations to whom it's not owed as a duty of justice. So far as individuals are concerned, on the other hand, I don't think actually, if you as an individual aim to promote good in the world, the way you should do it is not by reducing your emissions of greenhouse gas. That's a very expensive way of promoting good. If you reduce your emissions to zero in the cheapest possible way, which is by offsetting them, it'll cost you a few hundred pounds a year, something like that, to reduce all your emissions to zero, which is what I recommend you do. But you will do some good by doing that, because emissions do harm. And if you stop doing that, you will indeed stop doing those amounts of harm. But it's a relatively small amount of harm that you will prevent by doing that. You could use that same money to do a great deal more good in other ways. For example, Toby tells me that if you send it to a charity that cures tuberculosis, you're likely to save a life or two by that. You're likely to give people years or even decades of life, which is much more good than you could achieve by reducing your emissions to zero. So I don't think individuals actually have a duty of goodness to reduce their emissions. They have a duty of goodness, of justice, to reduce them to zero, simply because we have a duty not to inflict harm on other people. I don't offer this as a way of solving the problem of climate change or anything like that. I'm merely saying that's something we ought to do. Solving the problem of climate change is something governments are going to have to do, and they have rather different duties.
Well, try and connect what you say, this lovely talk, with the concerns you were expressing earlier this morning. I'm delighted that we get this stamp of approval from we as a collective body of economists. Obviously, yeah, proof of what you say.
And we have it on film.
And we have it on
film.
So does Partha's agreement, does that get that, is that on the film too?
Okay, so here's what went to my mind while you were speaking. I thought one of the great goals of economic thinking in welfare economics was to find ways by which individual motivations align themselves with the social good. So that's connected to your first question regarding firms. Now, where did this idea come from, that firms only owe their loyalty to the shareholders? Well, it's in a world in which there are no externalities. So you've devised second fundamental theorem of welfare economics. Use that as your basis for thinking of the social good beneficence. It's telling us that there is an organizational structure, mythical it may be, but at least it's more conceivable, such that we could, within those institutions, individuals would not have the huge burden of having to think about the universe every time they take a step. They care about themselves. The information gain is huge, the complexity of the problem is huge, and so forth, and yet, together, you're, in some sense, if the second fundamental theorem is taken seriously, that's to say, the welfare function, which is the kind that you would approve of, whatever that is, takes the poor into account, give their weight to them, and so forth, and so on, then we're in some sense solving this problem of the individual not having to think about the universe every time he does something. Is that right? Now, in that world, the individual will not have to bother about it. The incentives will be such, will they not? Or if not, why not?
I don't think so.
Okay, good. All right. Tell me now, why why isn't the amount of emission that the individual is...
Well, I mean, it's straightforward. Even in the first best solution, you know, you're paying your carbon taxes and everything. If you're emitting, you're still doing harm.
Oh, but I thought you were agreed that the harm has to be balanced with other things.
No, not this. Not that. Not in the case of justice. Justice tells you not to do harm, even for the sake of greater good. Now, okay, and this is, you know, this is an externality, this is a direct harm. You could worry about harms that are done through the operation of the market, but this is a direct harm you're doing.
You're essentially suggesting that justice ought to be eradicated from economic welfare economic thinking. I've done that.
No.
Because it is the balancing,
well,
isn't it?
Partly relevant point, not the same, but remember that in that argument, the second welfare theorem also says that the firm's managers have to fight off the temptation to try to do good if it reduces the profits to the shareholders. if they try to do good, they will also reduce welfare. And so they don't actually have quite the informational economy that we're used to assigning up to the competitive system.
So that's that is some lesson that has been drawn by people from stories about the effectiveness of competitive equilibrium, that actually it's a good idea to be self-interested. I don't think that's a conclusion that can be drawn. You know, I do think that even if you are in a perfectly competitive market and the externalities have been properly corrected by appropriate taxes and so on, you still have moral duties on you. And it may even be that your moral duties actually screw up what's going on in this perfectly competitive market. Look, I mean, there are clear practical conflicts between what governments are doing to achieve efficiency and what individuals ought to do.
Yeah. But we have the first best, not just efficient. It's the optimum. Okay, so that's the position.
So
and you're saying that in that world, I think there may be a play of words here. Committing harm, sure, I agree with you in the sense that anything which damages somebody else is a harm. But I thought it is then not possible to take a step. The Jans would say you can't take a step because you're killing somebody or the other. So we're living in a world where our actions have effects, myriad of effects, and the second fundamental theorem of welfare economics is designed to look at an institutional structure which, if it were possible to bring about, with beneficence as the objective, balances off, in the context of this beneficence objective function, the harms and benefits and so forth. That's my reading of the theory.
Yeah.
Now, there you could say, well, oh, it's your duty now to do less of this. I would say, what does it mean? After all, the fact that I would be doing some harm has been taken into account when the price system has been constructed and the tax subsidy system has been constructed.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm afraid I don't think that's good. I mean, let me appeal to Bernard Williams. So, you know, there's a difference between what you do and what is the causal result of what you do, where the causal result is mediated by the actions of other people. So the responsibility for what you do comes down to you. In the case of externalities, you are directly doing a harm to other people. It may be, in other ways, as you say, anything you do through the causal nexus is going to have the effect of harming other people. But that's something different. It's direct harms that I'm saying you shouldn't
do. Okay, so I feel a bit bad, but then I say, well,
but
I would feel bad no matter what.
Just to be clear on this, are you saying that if in a world in which there are no externalities, I would have no requirements of justice to other people? Because everything's mediated through the market. Is it the case that without externalities, this problem would arise? And even if you don't agree with Parthen's view about how much of the externalities you should mitigate, is it this case that everything that is in, about which you need to be concerned with justice, is in the set of things that have externalities?
I think that was extrapolating what I said. I was particularly talking about externalities and what we should do about them. So it didn't carry any commitments for what I would think if there weren't any externalities. And I don't know what to see. I mean, it would depend on other things. I mean, it's not externalities are not the only bad thing in life. There are other things too. And yeah.
So this is a kind of reframing of Parthen's point, perhaps, that if everyone were to suddenly start to follow your prescription, we would immediately run out of good quality offsetting projects.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to actually all try and bring our emissions to zero, we would bring the economy of the developed world to a standstill and actually cause a lot of harm to people now.
I don't think so. We're not going to do it, but if we all started doing it, the price of offsetting would certainly go up. This would be a major transfer from the rich to the poor. I don't think it's going to bring the economy to a halt.
There just aren't enough offsetting opportunities, certainly, that can be set up quickly, but I think in general. We can't solve the problem of climate change just by offsetting in the development. developing world. We really need to also cut our own emissions here, but we can't turn
yeah.
on a penny with that.
Of course, and if you tried to offset, and if a lot of us did it, I mean, it's very cheap at the moment because very few of us are doing it. There are these low-hanging fruit, they're called, in the developing countries. That's why it's so very cheap. If a lot of us did it, the price would go up. And then it would cease to be the cheapest way of reducing our emissions. Then we would have to start doing things like putting expensive insulation in our houses, not travelling around so much. So this is only an opportunity while it's cheap.
If a body of us build up doing this and that percentage increases and increases, then you can go to a good situation. But my point is that if everyone tried to do it tomorrow, you've got a problem. And this is, I think, a different take on how...
Well, maybe... Yeah, I mean, that's surely true, because the offsetting companies would be overwhelmed apart from anything else. But so what? I mean, why should I say...
There is a limit to the carbon-negative opportunities, so
yeah.
at some point you've got to start actually cutting emissions, and there is a limit to how fast you can cut emissions without doing harm to people now. That's my point.
Yeah, but look, I only said that you, I was addressing a number of people in the room, and myself, should do this, right? And I think, as a matter of fact, that each individual should do it. And I think that I think is true, and it would be true, even if it were the case that everybody did it, bad things would happen, because it's not the case that everybody will do it. Very few people will do it, as a matter of fact. So I don't see, you know, I'm not one of these universalizability people. I don't think that any moral rule has to be universalizable. This is a rule that depends on the particular situation where not everybody is acting according to the moral law or whatever it is.
John, my chair, have you got to the end of what you want to say?
Yeah, I mean, what happened after this is that I've got some notes that were on discounting, but I think we won't have a chance to do discounting unless people want to go back to discounting. But I think, you know, I'm quite happy not to say anything about discounting, so that's fine.
Our time's up, so anybody who has to go should feel free to get up and walk out there, at least for embarrassment. But it sounds like you're quite happy to go on talking about this issue for a while. Is that
right? Oh, I'm very
happy. Yeah.
So if I understand the distinction between the duty of justice and the duty of beneficence, to a certain extent, the duty of justice really doesn't require taking into account any kind of trade-off at the margin or anything like that, whereas the duty of beneficence, in that extent, would happen, right? So that you, like, it's much more absolute in that, well, we're not really worried about the margin, and things could become worse due to us essentially living up to our duty of justice. And in a way, you absolve government of this need, quite conveniently so, otherwise quite a few very crazy things would have to happen. I'm not sure I agree with that sort of absolution in a sense. But what about, I guess this comes back to the point of universalizability, is it every individual's duty of justice, essentially, to, in a democratic society, vote for a politician who prescribes essentially exactly that which the individual's duty of justice would require, thereby putting the government in a position where they're doing something which, because they have no duty of justice, they wouldn't have to do? I don't know, there's something a bit schizophrenic about this, which I don't quite understand myself.
Okay, so I make a distinction between what I call private morality and civic morality. So civic morality is the morality that requires you to do appropriate things to get your government to do what it ought to be doing. So that's related to what the government ought to be doing. So first we decide what the government ought to be doing, and then that tells us what our civic duty is. Now, actually, you're thinking about something else, I think, which is, should I use the instrument of government as a means of carrying out my private duty? I must say I hadn't thought of that. I thought that the easy means of carrying out my private duty is just to offset my emissions, rather than to go around doing something, rather than getting my government to do something. I'm not clear what my government could do that would
achieve my... That was the point that we were raising about the second fundamental theorem, because you were saying in your point that no matter what, even if you're sitting at the second fundamental on that allocation, I will have some regrets because it's I whose smoke is damaging somebody. Fine. But now you'd be saying, strictly speaking, that this tax system should be designed so that there will be a person-specific tax for that additional harm. And then you will have, but what you're saying is no matter what, there'll be some regret. Because if you start doing the calculation, you'd be saying, oh gosh, I did this. Of course, it is satisfying the beneficence rule, but it was I who, this is Bernard Williams, it's the Gupta, and I feel terrible, and it's not the fact that it was I who did it rather than him puts a burden on my conscience or whatever. But I thought the point is that you could have it person specific, why couldn't you do that?
I don't think it's my government's duty, my responsibility of my government, to make me perform my duty of justice. It's so you're implying that it was down to the government in some way or other to do this to me.
I was just simply saying that it's possible in principle. I'm not advocating it, because that would be incredibly encroaching on individuals.
Yes, exactly. It's down to individuals, not to, so I'm not, that's why I said I'm not clear what the government's what government could do to act as a means of my performing my duty of justice. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just a matter of how do we as individuals, us in this room, perform our duty of justice. And to some extent, to take a very particular example, we were having dinner with Professor Venables last week, and he's contributing to the IPCC sort of report, the next one up, and that's like his contribution in order to sort of inform government and further sort of action on that level. But in order to do that, the meeting of the panel was going to fly 74 economists to New Zealand, all of whom are essentially on the East Coast of the US and around here. And so in a way, on the one hand, they're doing their bit in order to inform government and others to mitigate this. So on that side, they're
well,
justice is being sort of a...
I assume they offset it. They better have.
Well, I don't... I have no idea how this...
Well, they should have done it, you know. If they were flying to New Zealand in order to go to that meeting, they certainly should have offset their emissions. Sorry?
Maybe just not fly to New Zealand for this meeting.
Well, that's a possibility too. So it depends what you think about the what can be achieved by the IPCC. And of course, that is a difficult question. I actually think that the IPCC is pretty influential and makes a difference. Certainly Working Group 1 has made a great deal of difference. It's the body that has put out the most authoritative statement of the science of climate change, which has been enormously influential. And without its work, I doubt if governments would be doing even the miserable amount that they are doing. Whether Working Group 3 is as effective, I don't know. But I'm on Working Group 3. At any rate, our chairman thinks that this is the future for the IPCC, because the science is already clear. You know, there's not really much more to be done about the science. The evidence increases, but everybody knows the position. And now the real question is what to do about it. And he thinks that this is principally an ethical problem. And it's the job, you know, it's the job of Working Group 3 to map a way through to do something about it. Now, maybe governments actually will never take any notice of what Working Group 3 says. It's certainly true that not many people read volumes 2 and 3 of the IPCC reports, or I haven't so far. No, not so. The chapter authored by Arrow, Stiglitz, and some other people on discounting has been enormously influential, actually, in a lot of economic thinking. So this was in the IPCC second review that came out in the mid-90s. That one chapter, which was a very nice, clear chapter, wrong, I think, but nevertheless very nice and clear, has been enormously influential in the way that it was one of the main things that restarted. Partha was talking about how this subject had sort of faded away. It was all sorted in the 70s, finished, tidied up by the 80s, but then it restarted, partly under the influence of climate change itself, but also spurred by this one particular chapter, which has stimulated a great deal of thinking about discounting since. So that was important.
Just to bring it back, we as individuals, even in our duty of justice, can, in our actions, do some trading off in that sense. We might decide to fly to New Zealand because we think that there is some larger benefit than the non-emitting.
No, I said they should emit it. They shouldn't do any emission. They should offset it. And I think that offsetting is actually a completely satisfactory way of preventing your emissions. Provided you do it properly, you don't emit. So what you do is you put 1 ton of carbon dioxide molecules into the atmosphere, but you take out a ton at the very same time. So the net effect on the atmosphere is nil, so you do not contribute to warming the atmosphere at all, so you do not do any harm. That's you can avoid doing harm by that means of offsetting. So that's what these people should do.
Yeah, there are also moral questions on the offsetting side. So I mean, a classic example is paying people not to cut down a forest. Another advertised scheme I've seen, which I don't have the reference, is to pay farmers in poor countries to continue using a manual pump, water pump, rather than the electric pump. We might have moral concerns about clean offsetting policies.
You certainly should. I didn't get to talk about offsetting, but Greenpeace is thoroughly against offsetting. Partly for what seems to me a very good reason. There is something serious to worry about. You've got to make sure that it genuinely is offsetting. So you've got to make sure, I mean, what you've got to do is make sure that the amount of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere after your actions is no more than it would have been had you not acted. So you've got to compare it with a counterfactual. And counterfactuals, the truth of counterfactuals is always a bit indefinite. So there is a real risk. And the thing about, you're thinking about cutting down of forests, which has been very, very controversial as a means of offsetting, I think is not a good means. I don't recommend people to use that means of offsetting. I think it's very important for forests to have a price and then to be traded on the carbon market at the government level. But that's because I don't think that at the government level, offsetting is the issue. The issue at the government level is just reducing emissions. And buying up forests can have the effect of reducing emissions. So I'm agreeing there are worries, but just because it's not easy to evaluate the counterfactuals, it doesn't mean that the counterfactuals aren't true. So it doesn't mean that it isn't possible genuinely to offset your emissions. If you're sufficiently cautious, you know, you overdo it and that sort of thing, I think you can be reasonably sure that you've managed to offset your emissions. I don't see anything wrong with paying farmers to use foot pumps. In fact, I think that's rather a nice idea.
If it inhibits development, it might be sort of dynamic.
Oh, well, I mean, according to the account of that I read, actually what happens is that very often they have to rent diesel-powered pumps from somebody or other and find themselves in debt as a result. So the process of using these diesel-powered pumps is actually socially a bad idea. I mean, one of the good things about good offsetting projects is that they can have what are called co-benefits in the jargon. They can do other good things as well as reducing the emissions of greenhouse gas. And I actually think that supplying foot pumps could be one of those. Another good one, I think, is providing efficient wood-burning stoves. Because that has health benefits as well as reducing emissions of greenhouse gas. I'm not against the foot pumps. They seem to be quite a good idea to me.
Maybe we should allow John to go. He's done an extraordinarily good job of dealing with our awkward questions. And we'd like to thank you very much.
Well, thank you all very much.